Welcome to this edition of Spitfire, Women of Color live in Montreal. We come together to say no to the silencing of our voices. We welcome you to this March edition of Spitfire on CKUT 90.3 FM. But first off, Spitfire would like to acknowledge that we are settlers on traditional territory of the Ganeagahaga people. The Ganeagahaga are the keepers of the eastern door of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, and Spitfire believes it is not enough to just acknowledge these keepers of the keepers of this land, and that everyone, ourselves included, should seek greater awareness and to actively confront colonialism and neocolonialism in their many forms, as well as to work to deconstruct and to decolonize. Starting points for self-education are reclaimturtleisland.ca and Idle No More. Thank you, Sophia, for joining us today in studio. You and your presence are greatly appreciated, and we hope that you will join us again in the future, sending out positive vibes to Victoria in Mexico, slash possibly Philippines, living her best life and working on her film.
We have a great show in store for you tonight. I'm going to go over some highlights of March just to start us off, and then we're going to lead into a discussion about March for Our Lives. We also have a great piece from Anne Audrey out in Toronto with a documentary filmmaker named Christian Hessing. And then finally, we're going to wrap it up with a self-care round like we do always and let you know how to reach us on Facebook and where to catch the show again. Stay tuned for Spitfire Women of Color Radio right here on CKUT 90.3 FM.
This is Anne Audrey on the mic, and I'm here in the lovely company of Chrisanne Hessing. And Chrisanne is a documentary filmmaker and digital media producer based in Toronto, dedicated to storytelling through fresh perspectives and new mediums. She has combined her love of travel and storytelling to produce award-winning short films that have screened around the world. Well, damn. Chrisanne was one of 8 Canadian participants in the Course Diverse Voices Fellowship through Hot Docs and was one of 20 emerging Canadian filmmakers selected for Rencontre Internationale du Documentaire de Montréal, which is Montreal International Documentary Festival Talent Lab. And her most recent project, Turning Tables, is a documentary portrait about Indigenous DJ Classic Roots, the two worlds that inspire is his music, his research for cultural freedom through his art. Well, hello there.
Hi.
How are you feeling tonight?
I feel good. I feel like I have really great energy tonight. So thank you for doing this interview.
I mean, thank you for for being with me, even if you lost part of your voice.
Yeah, thanks. I don't usually sound like this, but, you know.
Mm-hmm. The pure essence of your energy is there.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. All right. So let's get right into it. I am wondering, what is the drive and inspiration behind the projects that you usually start?
I guess the inspiration that is seen in most of my work comes from a lack of seeing work like the work that I do. I try to focus on voices that aren't usually heard, and especially ones that are misheard or not heard at all in today's times. I guess I would say also that there's a lot of diversity in my work because I love to explore different cultures and different perspectives. The world is just so rich with different people, different outlooks, different experiences, and in the films that I make, I try to show my best, like show in the best way the perspectives of other people that might not usually get a chance to have their voices heard.
That's beautiful and powerful as a woman of color to take up space and to also give space for other people of color for their stories to be heard and seen. That's really amazing. And considering that you are on Spitfire Women of Color Radio, I'm just also wondering about what role do you feel like that's playing, not only in the world, in the field, like what role in general do you feel like you're playing when you're choosing these stories that are not seen?
Well, I think the good thing about it is that right now, I think we're going through a time where I've never felt more at home with what I want to do, because everyone wants a piece of it. Everyone wants to be involved. They want to see more stories about diversity and resilience and hope and strength, and especially within from diverse perspectives. So I think it's just a great time to be doing what I do.
I actually have a following up question. Okay. I wonder, do you consider your work to be activism?
That's interesting. I read somewhere that there is a fine line between like documentary and journalism and even activism documentaries and all these kinds of things. And I think for me, the way that I look at documentary and what I want to do is that I don't want, or maybe it's not that I don't want to, but I haven't yet come across any subject matter that has, you know, really made me want to change laws more than it makes me want to change minds and change hearts. Mm-hmm. And I think to do that, that comes from an emotional connection. I guess it would be activism in a sense, because true activism, I suppose, comes from a change of heart, or, you know, learning something that you didn't know before that, you know, really affects your core and what makes you want to make a change. So I guess the answer is yes.
Well, thank you. It's definitely such a huge statement to make by choosing these stories and choosing this path. So it's pretty amazing. And so your most recent project, you directed Turning Tables, and it's actually premiering at Hot Docs this year. Congratulations. You totally deserve it. And do you want to tell us a little bit more about this documentary?
Okay, so Turning Tables, it's a short documentary following Classic Roots, who's a Toronto-based techno DJ and powwow dancer who's pioneering powwow techno. And the film is just about his work as a musician, as a dancer, overall as an artist. And we do also spend a lot of time focusing on the ways in which he gives back to his community by, you know, giving workshops and, concerts for First Nations youth.
Wow. Wow. And I have to ask you, so, you know, we have often talked about just the ability to share one's story. And I'm wondering, like, within that process, since you're saying that, like, yes, it's also the ability to make a change of heart, a change of mind throughout this doc, how was it to portray someone else's story, but also directing it at the same time, kind of having a vision in mind at the same time?
So I learned a lot about the process of documentary in just making this film, and how much just by wanting something so badly, you can change the way things pan out. And I think there's a fine line in documentary. They say that you should always have a plan, but be prepared to change it at any moment. And I felt that way a lot through this, because the thing with documentary, the beautiful thing about documentary is that, you know, it's real life in real time, and things happen that are out of your control. So a lot of the time throughout the process, I was wondering, what actually am I directing? But I was talking with a friend about this earlier, that you are not in control of the things that happen, but what you decide to do with what does happen, that's where the directing comes in. It's like, where do you choose to point the camera? Like, if something's going on, where you choose to point the camera, just on who you choose to point it on, that could change the entire story, right? And so there's something so profound about that, but at the same time, you are letting life play out. And I don't know, that's something that I really am thrilled by in that work.
Yeah, that's powerful. And I feel like it reinforces what you were just saying about choosing to share certain stories, right? Mm-hmm. Choosing to portray or show what's not necessarily seen, or choosing to for the voices that are not necessarily heard to be heard. Mm-hmm. So like when you were talking about like directing and where to point the camera, what to choose when it's unfolding. It's just a beautifully curated way to do things.
I will also say though that something that I guess I underestimated in directing for documentary, I guess I thought there would be a lot of, oh, you know, well, like things will pan out and we'll just follow it as it happens. But, and while that's the case, there are an awful lot of decisions that need to be made. And especially like for a film like Turning Tables, there were so many beautiful moments, super impactful moments that happened that I had to decide to, you know, leave on the cutting room floor because it just didn't serve the overall purpose, or, you know, maybe it's for a bigger film or another film. But there were a lot of like decisions that I had to make. And of course I made them in collaboration with Classic Roots and how he wanted to have his story told. And I think what we ended up with was something really, really great.
Yes, that's again beautiful, but it sounds like also a painful process. Yeah. Where
it's not easy.
And going back to that documentary, so Turning Tables, where again it's definitely a statement where you go against the representation of Indigenous peoples in the media. So how do you feel like this film or this short documentary or such storytelling is going to shift the perspective or change people's heart or mind?
Well, I think what we always wanted to do with this doc is try to find a way to just mirror the energy of Josh, who's Classic Roots. If you ever get a chance to meet that guy, he is infectious in his positive energy, in his outlook on life, his just general optimism. And that is just something in general the world does not have enough of. It seems that way. And at least I could say that in mainstream media, if there's there's like an extreme lack of that. And I wanted this film, I always wanted it to be a celebration. A celebration of culture, a celebration of identity. And in that, just kind of renewing that kind of childlike mentality that you can do anything that you want to do. If you just, like, it doesn't matter where you come from, it's possible to look to the future without losing sight of the past. And I think that's something that Classic Roots does beautifully in the way that he produces his techno music, but also dances to the beat of the true Anishinaabe sounds in his music.
Wow. No, I'm actually speechless because it's so beautiful how you seem to focus on this such personal story, but at the same time to reflect such a powerful message that can reach so many different audiences.
Yeah, I think it really is just it's a universal theme, you know? Everyone at some point is at that cusp of, okay, who am I, but who do I want to be and how do I get there? And I think it's especially relevant for not only Indigenous youth, but just even first or second generation immigrants, people who are caught between these two cultures. I myself am a first generation immigrant, and growing up in Canada, but being born in India, I've constantly felt, and I still feel, this kind of rift between, you know, where I come from versus who I am now and what I've grown up to be. So that was, again, like another thing that we really wanted to tackle, and in a positive way, right? Not to show that, oh, it could be so hard. We wanted to only focus on the positive elements of what it's like when you choose to follow your dreams, because, you know, these things are real and they happen. And it's a feel-good film is essentially what it is. So
definitely felt good when I watched the trailer. And it's such a necessary film, a necessary space, a necessary message. And the ability to dream, I feel like that's something that's often brushed off or put aside because of having to survive or having to basically abide by responsibilities, especially with everything that's happening in the world, with all these, you know, this news that can be so, bring so much sadness, so much isolation. And within that realm, like, how are you able to maintain your vision or maintain that positivity to kind of continue to pursue your dreams or to pursue your heart?
Well, I'd say it definitely gets tough, especially with how often negative depictions of especially Indigenous people, Indigenous youth are portrayed in the media. It gets tough when you see just how often this happens, but it also serves as a reminder as to why stories like Joshua's story and films like Turning Tables need to be seen by the masses. People need a good dose of positivity these days, right? And I mentioned earlier that just stories of resilience and hope and strength, these are things that are really lacking in our society. And, you know, if it can affect just one person, who knows what that can lead to, you know? Like, it's a domino effect of things. But I'd say that other than just, you know, having the privilege of being around Josh, who's super positive all the time, and, you know, knowing that we're going to try to get this film out there to as many people, especially Indigenous youth, who I think, you know, deserve to see it, deserve to have this kind of burst of light, you know, especially from someone like them. I think that's what really gets me through it.
Yeah. I'm getting teary-eyed. But it's just so real, so real. And the fact that not only did you have the project of directing the film and just the making the film in the first place, having that idea and like pursuing that vision, but not only that, but now there's a part two, bringing that film into communities. Like, how amazing and coming full circle is that? Like, going back to the roots of what community is. And talking about change of heart, but doing that directly, like, what do you have to say about that?
So it's really funny, the things that you learn. And I think in general, again, another thing that I love about documentary, or I guess just filmmaking in general, is that it's a process. And they say that if the film that you end up with is the film that you had in mind when you first started, it's probably not a good film. Which means that, you know, you wouldn't have learned anything if it's the same thing. But I can say that I was pleasantly surprised along the way of what I learned about Josh, about the story that we were trying to tell, you know, what we're developing now in advance, or, you know, after the film's premiere next month, is a tour of the film. That will see the film and Joshua and some of the other artists that we worked with in the process. Wow. We'll take all this to different First Nations communities around Ontario. You know, the bigger goal is cross Canada, nationwide, but we're starting provincial right now, and to just continue what we see in the film, which are these workshops, it's these interactions with the youth. Letting them get their hands on the turntables and, you know, watch the film. And we're going back to the roots, I guess. That's the next step.
Mm-hmm. How beautiful. How beautiful. Well, this is so exciting. I feel like I want to watch it like so many times. And so how can people support? Can they get in contact with you or learn about the different screenings so that they can go watch it?
So in terms of our world premiere, as we mentioned, it's going to be at Hot Docs Film Festival in Toronto. And our world premiere is April 30th next month. But we've got a couple of other screenings. We're going to be screening in the shorts program at the festival. And all that information can be found on Hot Docs website. The film is called Turning Tables. So if you search for the film in their website, you'll see it there. But we've got a website as well, www.turningtablesdoc.com, mm-hmm. where you can get more information about the film. And they could also reach out to us online. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Turning Tables Doc. And if you stay tuned, follow us on social media, and our website will be sure to post about any upcoming screenings.
We'll make sure to post that on Spitfire Radio's Facebook so that you get that information as well. Thanks again for having this enlightening conversation with me tonight. Very appreciated. And I hope everyone at home gets to go watch it or gets more information about it, because this is an exciting and necessary project.
We'll hopefully be coming to Montreal in the fall, but we'll keep you posted about that.
Ooh, yes. Yeah. All right. Well, we'll have a good night.
The Montreal Sessions. For the month of March, we'll be opening up the CKUT time capsule and looking back at 30 years of freeform freakout radio. Tune in every Tuesday from 3 until 5 p.m.
coming on down the line.
This is Spitfire Women of Color Radio on CKUT 90.3 FM. It's about 6:35 and about 6 degrees outside. Welcome back. We're just getting caught up on the month of March here, so happy International Women's Month, whatever that means to you. Shout out to all the white women out there. This is your month. Make it rain. So basically, just a quick catch-up of what happened this month. The big news this month is definitely March for Our Lives between the Parkland shooting and March for Our Lives. It's been a lot of news about gun violence, so don't worry, we're going to talk more about that in just a little bit. What else happened this month? Well, this Snapchat had a bad month, that's for sure. Snapchat ran an ad, disgusting ad about would you rather slap Rihanna or punch Chris Brown. Considering the domestic violence that Rihanna's experienced, this is just completely disgusting. But of course, Rihanna came out on Snapchat and she said, "Now, Snapchat, you know you're not my favorite app out there. But I was just trying to figure out what the point of this mess was." Since she's called Snapchat out, they've dropped more than 4% in their value. I think rightfully so. What else has happened this month? I saw Wrinkle in Time this month, yeah, which was awesome because I saw it the same weekend that Black Panther was number one movie and Wrinkle in Time was number two movie, which is the first
Wakanda
time in
forever,
history.
Guys.
Wakanda forever, exactly. So that was a great weekend. And then in Montreal, we've got a lot of news coming out. Right now, we've got a young Black boy missing. His name is Ariel. He was last seen maybe, I think, about 10 days ago. He's 4'7", weighs 88 pounds. He was last seen in a black coat with a hood, gray pants, and yellow shoes. He's missing from Hunsick, so keep an eye out for him. We're sending love to his family. Also happening this month, Chassin, the Black-owned bookstore, is having a fundraiser. So they're having a flash day sale with the tattoo studio Minuit 10. That's going to be on March 31st at Chassin from noon to 7. Hope to see you there. And then also, just to spice it up, Groove Nation's having a really fun show this month, and the theme of it is women of color and BIPOC. So love to see you there. Strange Roots is going to be there, and so a bunch of people are going to be there. Keep an eye out for that. I believe that's tomorrow night starting at 10.
Thanks, Michelle.
No problem.
No pants on when I go to bed. I eat the dirt, then I spit out lead. No sketch pad, I use the ground. I draw noises, I paint with sounds. Got bright red brush strokes, kites high like green tokes. You smoke the jokes and I laugh, cry. Trying to keep a straight face, bitch samurai. Got a laptop and a lipstick. Rap game, Madri Dixit. Chocolate, lime juice, ice cream. Don't bluff or mistrust. Wanderlust for a home above mountains, you know, tall peaks. Ask me how I'm doing and I say teak. Tu sister now, my eyebrows, brown girl hair on fleek. Remember days some white girls told me I looked ugly. Now they coloring them eyebrows, trying to look all hairy. Now they letting their brows grow. Our own so carefree, but we was doing it all along. Every life of dancing, we was doing it all along. Every life of dancing, never thought my hairy styles would be the new direction. Western world sees brown beauty as an imperfection. I joke, I kid, I rhyme, I spit, but right now I'm talking serious shit. This globe, I wish we quit. This shit is making me hella seasick. I'll puke on your face, give you a little taste of what's inside of me. You can check my passport if you wanna clarify my identity. They asked me, what kind of brown are you? Are you the type to be straight? strapped to a bomb or two. They asked me, what kind of brown are you? Are you the type to be strapped to a bomb or two? They asked me, what kind of brown are you? Are you the type to be strapped to a bomb or two? They asked me, what kind of brown are you?
Welcome back to Spitfire Women of Color Radio on CKUT 90.3 FM. That was the powerful Horsepower with Eyebrows on Fleek. Okay, well, that didn't come out right. That's okay. Live radio, guys. So we're now going to dive into a quick discussion about the March for Our Lives protest that took place on March 24th this year, this month, in Washington, D.C. The focus of this discussion is not so much on the march, but rather the ways in which the public's reception of the student-led protest is deeply contrasted to that of the Black Lives Matter protest over the last few weeks. Keep in mind, both protests center around sensible gun laws, the value of their lives, and a demand for the government for government accountability on in terms of the senseless killings of individuals due to gun violence. However, it seems like what lawmakers are making clear and what they're hearing is that it's not so much the message, but more so the makeup of the crowd. A predominantly white crowd saying exactly what a predominantly Black crowd has been saying since 2012. So, I mean, those who were presenting did kind of acknowledge their privilege and shared the stage with POC voices, emphasizing the importance of including the voice of people of color in this conversation. So my thoughts to all of you in studio, what were some of the thoughts that or feelings that this march invoked in you, around you?
I guess, like, it evoked a kind of, like, bittersweetness, I guess, because there was like finally widespread attention on this very important issue, which is gun violence in general, but especially gun violence, because it's like such a spontaneous type of violence, I guess. It can be really, really widely destructive for a second. But yeah, so, and it was great. I was like, great, this is exciting that there's finally attention on this, and, you know, there's movement, and there seems to be a little bit of political support, but not so much. But then, yeah, there was the bitterness of being like, okay, well, we've said all this stuff before. Right. And, like, none of this is new. So it kind of just brings up the same feelings that the Me Too movement did. I was like, great, we're talking about this thing that's really, really important. And like,
but again, you're excluding.
But then, you know, Black women have been saying this for a really long time, and the Black woman started the movement, and then just all her work was kind of erased. And I feel like a very similar thing is happening with the March for Our Lives in terms of like Black Lives Matter and all the work that Black people have done to set the stage to even have these discussions.
Right.
I definitely feel the same way. I also feel like reading through testimonies of people, of predominantly Black people who went to the march, it did not feel like like marching for people's lives. It felt more like a celebration. If there were speakers and people dancing, and they're like PETA showed up and was like, gun violence is related to animal cruelty.
They
always show up, which is a good tactic, you know, like that's what
that's what Westboro Baptist Church does too.
Exactly.
Shows up
there. They just always show up, and they're always there, and that's how they, like, it's not enough for them to have their own kind of causes. They need to also appropriate.
It's an opportunist movement.
Exactly. And so a lot of what I was reading was people just being like not feeling comfortable at all, and also experiencing racism in at the march from white people. And there was diversity on with the people that spoke, with the students who spoke, diversity with the artist who showed up, but that's because you won't get a lot of white artists showing up for that cause, first of all. Second of all, the ones that will come will only come to events like March for Our Lives. They will not be showing up to Black Lives Matter movements. And just like Chase said, Black people have been leading this movement forever, because guns don't only affect safety in schools, but safety in homes and safety in the street and safety in the court, like safety in every single space that Black bodies occupy. And so, for me, it was a lot of hypocrisy and a lot of feeling cheated from a movement that has been led by Black folk since the very beginning, and more predominant, and particularly Black women, trans folk, and non-binary people. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I'm bitter.
you're more bitter than bitter. Yeah.
Don't apologize for it. I have every right to it. Like, I want to come back to the what you had mentioned about safety in classrooms, etc., and this whole discussion about arming teachers now. And I remember coming across an article where it was this Black mother said, if you arm teachers, I'm pulling my Black son out of class. And it seems like they're not understanding the power dynamics within a classroom when you do have Black students, especially young Black men. If, let's say, for whatever reason, they are very reactionary, what is your first instinct going to be? Pull up the gun? And then what? Yeah. What are you going to say? He had a gun on him? No, he's in class. What weapon would he have? What would justify you pulling out your weapon in the middle of a class?
Yeah.
Yeah. And basically, like, yeah, that was a reaction already to, like, bring security guards and stuff like that into schools. And they haven't stopped any... Like, so if you want to go from, like, a statistical or research basis, it doesn't make sense, because there's been 100,000, I believe, like, security officers implemented in schools since Columbine, and they haven't stopped any mass murders. They've actually harmed more students, and they've mostly arrested a lot of students for basic things like talking back or, you know, insubordination or stuff like that. We can think of the girl who was beat up really badly by a police security guard.
Karma desk.
Because... like, I think her mom was sick and she was, like, looking at her phone to see if
mom was
okay. And then, yeah. So they've already enacted a lot of violence on people of color, especially Black people. So when it becomes teachers that have it and they're already overworked and already stressed and underpaid, like, teachers get paid peanuts, especially in the United States. So that's a really bad recipe for disaster. That's... I don't even want to think about it.
Yeah, and if I can also add that Black children are already criminalized. Like, if we think of Tamir Rice, if we think of all these children who are children but are seen as threatening because of being Black, mixing that with... So because of that, they're already... seen as angry, as violent. Their whole existence have been...
They're not allowed to be children. They're already...
Exactly. Yeah.
And seen as adults.
And in general, even if it's not young children, their whole existence is criminalized. And so having... And they've already been affected by that criminalization. So Black kids, especially young boys, are more likely to get expelled from school for... less than nothing. Mm-hmm. And so bringing guns into the mix is a really bad idea. Also, retired police officer who became a teacher at a high school brought his gun
and
to
it
class.
Went off in class.
And it went off in class. And, like, nobody was shot, but fragments from the bullet, from the everything shattering, did hurt students. And so... it's definitely a bad idea, and it's definitely going to mean more Black and brown bodies dead.
Mm. One thing that happened in the same week was Stephon Clark, who was gunned down in his grandmother's backyard on March the 18th. The march took place on the 24th, the same week, Sunday to Saturday. 24th was Saturday, the Friday. And to my knowledge, anyway, I don't know if any of you have heard anything, there hasn't been... a public outcry from politicians for, let's say, again, more restrictions in terms of police accountability, in terms of changing procedures of how they apprehend individuals, especially if they are not sure of whether or not there is a weapon involved. Do you think the irony is kind of lost on the public that this happened the exact same week that we're trying to have this, like, national outcry for gun reform and gun legislation, yet we still have the police doing exactly the same BS they've been doing for the last God knows how long.
If I can go, I don't think that the irony has been lost on them. I think it just shows who in our society is expendable, mm-hmm. who we care for, who we want to protect, and black bodies are not on that list. Mm-hmm. I think the complete, and there hasn't been silence or inaction for, in this particular case, like Black Lives Matter activists and protesters shut down a highway.
Mm-hmm. And the NBA finals too.
Yeah. Exactly. And yeah, I think I saw today that they were in the municipal court. Yeah,
his brother came.
Exactly. And so the only silence comes from white people and privileged people. And it just, it's like necropolitics, right? It's who in our society is expendable, who don't deserve to be saved, who doesn't deserve to access certain resources. And that's how we see like our neighborhoods being abandoned. And actually Robin Maynard in her book mentions it, that mm-hmm. it wasn't just an abandonment, but it was an organized abandonment mm-hmm. of our communities. And mm-hmm. I think it plays in the same kind of like reality as and situation as this murder, because it wasn't an accident. It wasn't like it can't, there's no way to not be for it to not be called a murder.
Mm. Yeah. Sorry.
No, go for it.
Oh, yeah. And I remember in the same week, I remember reading an article about, I think it was the Colorado Police Department, that they would carry around fake guns to plant on people yeah. that they killed. So this is a thing that a police officer admitted in court, is that it was routine practice to carry around plastic guns so they can just drop it on a body once they've already killed them. So like in my mind, that's premeditated murder. And but it's, the way I see it is kind of like the police are part of the government. They're an arm of the government, and they're the enforcing body of the mm-hmm. government's laws and legislations. So it kind of makes sense for politicians not to say anything mm-hmm. because, like, I don't know if you're going to, like, really critique, like, your brother or, like, your best friend or whoever is, you know, your bodyguard or, right. you know, you're probably going to defend that person who's in the same family as you. And yeah, so I think to have gun reform and to have police reform will be really, really difficult unless we have different politicians in play, because mm-hmm. right now we have the same type of people doing the same type of work in cahoots with the same organizations or corporations, stuff like that. And the system just goes on and on and on and on like that. But I guess it would take taking out those corrupt elements and replacing them with, mm-hmm. you know, more socially and community-minded people who actually care. And then maybe there might be change, but yeah, I don't know.
That just brings about the question, like, if we don't speak up for ourselves, because we're the same ones who are speaking up for, like, Black, trans, Indigenous, mm-hmm. women of color, people of color, and then there's nobody there to be like, okay, well, yes, you too deserve to have all of us come out for you in solidarity.
Yeah. I think that's something I last week facilitated an event on anti-Black racism within racialized but non-Black communities. Mm-hmm. So people of color, but non-Black people of color. And something that we discussed extensively is that Black folks show up. Like, yeah. like they will show up to every protest. They will show up for every movement of relating to oppression. They will mm-hmm. show up for... and I say this, but also there are Muslim Black people, but they will show up, like, for example, when the Charter of Quebec Values was about to be passed into law, Black people showed up for Jewish folk, for Muslim women, like,
yeah, we're always there and supporting other people and trying to yeah. use our skills and energy and talent and everything to help others. And then when it comes to us, especially Black women, Black queer people, it's just like,
yeah. And it's, you know, makes me think of, sorry.
No. And people just kind of make up the most ridiculous excuses for why not.
Yeah.
I've heard too, for people who like claim to be like pro-Black or whatever, make up just like the most ridiculous excuses because why they can't support Black people particularly. Yeah.
And it's like one of the testimonies from the march from a Black person who was there was they could see people like stopping by, like police who were on site for protection. Quote, like I just did.
Airports.
Y'all can see it.
For those who can't see for the radio.
And so you had a bunch of white people just stopping and thanking the officers. And that's just... like what, 2 or 4 days after a major shoot, like 20 was shot, Simon Clark was shot 20 times for holding his cell phone. And that's again plays into we're seen as a threat, whatever is done.
What you just said, I don't know if you've watched on Netflix, sorry, Monique, 7 Seconds.
Yes, thank you. Okay, yes.
So it's, like, when you just said, when, like, people, like, walking up to... Anyway, I don't want to spoil it for anyone, but if you have a chance to go and watch it, go and watch it, because it's literally taking everything that's happened, let's say, like, the Trayvons and the Tamir Rices and basically every young Black boy that's been killed senselessly by a cop, and just putting it into, like, one series, but in a different context. This time, it's a hit and run.
Okay.
But the underlying message is still the same. People are still going to see a young Black boy and not think that, oh, you know, he may have been a good student. He had a family that loved him. He wasn't a gangbanger. He wasn't on drugs. He wasn't being mischievous because, like, he was found in some obscure location.
Mm.
It's always that these already these prejudgments that are placed in that play into the justice system to the point where at the end, you're just drained. And honestly, at the end of that, I was like, yes, we're finally going to get justice for what? Even if this is all fictional, like, whatever.
Yeah.
No, it comes back to the same. It's like you put in all this energy. You see the Black community putting in all this energy for it all just get shoved in their faces. And it's like you're getting the wind knocked out of you all over again.
Yeah, absolutely. It gets really discouraging. And yeah, I guess, how do I say, if you want to say something, because I still think.
I guess, yeah, we are denied basic... like base, not only rights, but also
humanity.
Yeah, we're
seen as human yet.
Exactly,
still.
We're really not, and that's something that we really need to think about. Is that we, like Black folk, were property in Canada and in the U.S. not so long ago.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and all these years of enslavement and of white dominance has institutionalized the fact that we're expendable. We're property, and so we don't deserve the same levels of respect. And we're not only denied those, but we're also denied any type of recourse for justice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because the system, all those systems weren't built with us in mind. Mm-hmm. When they say we the people, they didn't include us. We weren't people.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm a bad bitch, nigga, you can't kill me. No, you can't smoke me out, just $100 bill me. These niggas kill me, acting like I owe them something. A grown woman, I won't sacrifice myself for nothing. I'm going places, making plays, I got a bigger vision. I'm tired of $20 booty calls and supervision. You was a star until you went and tried to play the moon. You broke my heart and then I turned into a fucking goon. Yeah, I'm a bad bitch, nigga, you can't kill me. No, you can't take me out, I can't show you the real me. Smoking Colorado dope, keep your mid-grade dick. Burning money all week on my hot girl shit. I'm a bad bitch, nigga, you can't kill me. I've been my own fucking shooter for a while. Bitches funny style, acting like a child. I got 4 of those. I'm not trying to keep up competition with you silly hoes. Beefing over clothes, hating from outside the club. Cause they niggas show me love as if he could ever handle me. I can't take your nigga, but that shit don't take away from you. These niggas never bad, they better love on you more better, boo. Tell them I'm a bad bitch,
nigga, you can't kill me. Yeah, you can take me out the hood, but bitch, I'm still me. I'm not gonna switch up my persona for no white folks. I'm not gonna bite or swallow tongues, cause bitch, I might choke. I need a whip that's clean enough to check my makeup in. Cause you know mirrors treat you better than a fucking friend. They blending in, so they be eggy when you standing out. We're supposed to shine together, now you acting cubic. I'm a diamond, I'm a bad bitch. Nigga, you can't kill me. I put it on him when I wanna and he paid me. He don't like my pockets empty, he don't play me. But he won't keep me cause I can't give him a baby. Fuck it, I'm a bad bitch, nigga, you can't kill me. I used to dream about the day that you would kill me. Was trying to feel you, but you wasn't the real you. You gotta FaceTime your kids and I know that ain't cool. Keep niggas out from around my kids because they never stay. It ain't no Uncle Mike, no mama's friend, no Uncle Ray. I gotta look out for my little ones, that's fucking game. I put a hole in you for one of them and ain't a thing. Keep niggas out from around my kids because they never stay. It ain't no Uncle Mike, no mama's friend, no Uncle Ray. I gotta look out for my little ones, that's fucking game. I put a hole in you for one of them, it ain't a thing, bitch.